Like most of us, I grew up with mostly male superheroes. Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. Maybe that's why I remember so clearly the first time Batgirl showed up. I must have been 8 or 9, and honestly, it had not occurred to me until then that a girl could fight crime and save the world and do it riding a really cool black motorcycle. I wanted to be Batgirl. And that is why superwomen matter, because they're icons of female power and agency, and they can shape little girls and even grown women's dreams and fantasies. And now, after all those years of being sidelined as girlfriends, sluts, or bitches, they're taking center stage. For example, Wonder Woman is back. DC Comics and Warner Brothers have at least 2 films planned. And yes, okay, she's a warrior princess in a miniskirt, strapless top, and knee-high boots. She is still a feminist icon. In fact, historian Jill Lepore recently discovered that Wonder Woman and her creator were intimately tied to the women's movement in the early 20th century. She told Steve Paulson how she uncovered their secret history.
So I'd been asked by The New Yorker to write a piece about Planned Parenthood and its history. And Planned Parenthood was founded in 1916 in Brooklyn by Margaret Sanger, a nurse, and her sister Ethel Byrne, who was also a nurse who opened the first birth control clinic in the United States. So I set out researching the history of Planned Parenthood, and I went to read Margaret Sanger's papers, which are at Smith College. I was reading through those papers, and meanwhile, I was working on a different project for a talk I was giving at the Yale Law School on the history of evidence. I was really interested in the history of the lie detector. So I'd been reading about this guy, William Moulton Marston, who invented the lie detector. And you can find out very much about Marston. His papers weren't anywhere. But if you looked him up on Wikipedia, you got this weird thing, like William Moulton Marston invented the lie detector when he was a Harvard undergraduate and went on to create Wonder Woman in 1941. and that in and of itself is just like, okay, that's just weird. Like, who does both of those things? Like, he seems so interesting.
And it turns out he is this totally fascinating character who wore sort of many different hats and sort of, I don't know, intersected with history at different points.
Yeah, well, and he's endlessly fascinating. But anyway, at that point, at the kind of Wikipedia level, there was also this sort of weird note that he believed in polyamory. So he was married to his sweetheart, but they had brought into their house a woman named Olive Byrne to live with them, and they raised 4 children together, Marston and these 2 women. Well, anyway, then back at Smith, reading Margaret Sanger's papers and the Planned Parenthood papers, I kept finding letters from Olive Byrne to Margaret Sanger and realized that she was Ethel Byrne's daughter, that is, the daughter of Margaret Sanger's sister, who had also founded Planned Parenthood in 1916 and then was drummed out of the movement.
Wait, so just to put this in perspective, so William Marston's mistress was the niece of Margaret Sanger, one of the founders of Planned Parenthood. I mean, the woman who brought us the birth control pill.
Right, and in fact coined the phrase birth control. And it turns out that Wonder Woman is based on Margaret Sanger. Like, that Wonder Woman who comes to the United States to fight for women's rights is actually inspired by Margaret Sanger and is sort of the icon of the reproductive rights movement. And it was hidden because Marston's family arrangements were so wildly controversial that they were kept secret for years and years and years. So I had this sort of moment in the archives. I was like, oh, no, I found out something about Wonder Woman that people need to know.
And just to elaborate on this strange family arrangement. So Marston was married to Elizabeth Holloway. He had this mistress, Olive Byrne. They all lived together for years. Both had children with him. And they seemed to kind of coexist, I don't know if harmoniously is the right word, but they got along.
It's an extraordinarily unusual arrangement given where they lived. Like, they started out sort of, at least Olive Byrne started out in Bohemia, like in Greenwich Village. That's where Ethel Byrne and Margaret Sanger lived. And in 1925, when Marston was a professor at Tufts outside of Boston, he met Olive Byrne. She had Marston as her professor, and they fell in love. And Marston, you know, just told his wife that this would solve all their problems because she wanted to have children. And at the time, this is the sort of early generation of women going to college and having professions. And Marston's wife was working. She wanted to have children. She didn't want to stop working. And Marston, oh, I have a good idea. We'll bring this young woman who's 10 years younger than you are. She would love to raise your children and, you know, be my mistress. And you know, you can keep working and she'll raise the children. And so each woman had 2 children. And that is indeed what happened. Marston and his wife worked and Olive Byrne stayed home and took care of all 4 children.
Wow. Incredible story. So how does Wonder Woman come out of all of this?
So they had these kids, and Olive Byrne got a job working for Family Circle magazine. This is just a hoot. As a staff writer, and her job was to tell American housewives who picked up Family Circle at the grocery store, you know, how to have a happy home life.
A happy, probably conventional home life.
Yeah, except, you know, not so much Family Circle, but Family Triangle. So in her stories in Family Circle, Olive Byrne she had this whole ruse. She would go to visit world-famous consulting psychologist William Moulton Marston. Marston was quite famous. He was like a kind of Dr. Oz kind of figure. So Byrne would go visit him. She would ask him questions about how to raise her children, without, of course, revealing that she lived in a house with him and her children were his children. And one day she goes to see him to ask him, you know, whether comic books are good or bad for children. And he says, oh, no, comic books are great for kids. Well, M.C. Gaines, who is the publisher of the Justice Society comics, which have Superman and Batman and all these other superheroes, is delighted by this because he has a huge PR problem. People are, like, actually burning comic books in town commons in the 1930s. And so he brings Marston into his office and he says, yeah, I read this great article by this Olive Byrne Family Circle, and, you know, I'd love to hire you as a consultant. And so Marston's hired as a consultant. And Marston says, undoubtedly, partly at the behest of his wife and of Olive Byrne, the thing, though, that would be really good for your PR problem is if you had a female superhero, because most of the critics are actually just complaining about the masculinity and the violence of the comics. But if you had a female superhero who was fighting for women's rights and whose weapon was truth and who believed in love and who never killed her enemies, well, your critics could say nothing against you.
And so we got the green light to create Wonder Woman.
Yeah, so Gaines said, oh, well, that's great, but why don't you write it? So Marston creates Wonder Woman, and Olive Byrne at home types up all the scripts, and they hire an artist, and they create Wonder Woman. And the thing is, his model for Wonder Woman was not just Sanger, but all the suffragists from the 19-teens and the feminists from the 19-teens, all of the sort of secret tricks that Wonder Woman has actually come from the suffrage and feminist and birth control movements of the 1910s.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And so Wonder Woman is this, you know, very strong woman. She also looks like a pinup girl.
Yeah, and Marston loved that about her. So Marston, he was a great fan of pornography and erotica, as were many people in the comic book industry. This is a really close, remains a really close and deeply troubling, distressing relationship between comic books as a genre and men's magazines, say. So, and Marston came out of that tradition of men's magazines. You know, Esquire had started in 1933. Marston was a staff writer for Esquire. Esquire was the first, you know, gentleman's magazine to have these pinups, you know, the kind of Betty Grable, leggy, busty, thin-waisted, pomaded girl. That was the aesthetic of the 1940s when Wonder Woman was created. And Marston really believed in female beauty of that sort. He would have a kind of deeply elaborate psychological explanation for this, but also he clearly, this was just his thing.
Well, and then if there's one other feature of Wonder Woman's character that if she is chained up, she loses her superhuman strength. And so there is scene after scene of her getting chained up. I mean, basically bondage imagery. Where does that come from?
Yeah, so it was really controversial, mainly because she's chained up all the time. And so the comic was banned and became really controversial. And Marston was asked to defend it again and again and again. And he would say, look, she is an allegory for the emancipation of women. And in order for that allegory to be delivered in basically a book for children, it has to be through symbolism. So she has to be chained up in each issue so that she can break free of her chains and show that women are emancipated and that they can emancipate themselves and no one needs to rescue them. And it's puzzling on the one hand, and it is obviously a kind of fetish, right?
Uh-huh. I mean, there's something kinky going on here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's undeniably kinky and kind of concerning in that way. But on the other hand, women chained or roped up and breaking up those bonds was the central iconography of the suffrage movement. And in fact, later on, of the birth control movement. This was actually, Marston didn't make this up. This is what women did. This is how women choose to represent their enslavement.
So I have to ask you, is Wonder Woman actually a feminist icon?
Well, one of the reasons I felt so strongly that the book needed to be written is that she certainly fills in a piece of American political history. So people sometimes talk about the history of the struggle for equality for women as occurring in waves. Like there's this first wave that starts in 1848 with the Declaration of Rights, the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York. And then that first wave ends in 1920 with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And then there's a second wave begins around 1963. Betty Friedan publishes The Feminine Mystique, and then we have, you know, Gloria Steinem and Ms. Magazine 1972 and so forth. That's the second wave. And then, but the idea is that between 1920 and 1963, there was nothing going on. There was a lull, like a still ocean. But if you think about Wonder Woman, created in 1941, as being inspired by Sanger and the suffragists and feminists of the 19-teens, she actually then goes on to be the inspiration for a lot of women involved in that so-called second wave in the 1960s.
And Gloria Steinem, right, was a big fan of the character of Wonder Woman.
Read Wonder Woman as a kid, as a girl, really influenced her. She put Wonder Woman on the very first issue of Ms. Magazine in 1972. Wonder Woman comics are re-released by Ms. Magazine. Wonder Woman really does become an icon of the feminist movement in the early 1970s. So if you unveil the secret history of Wonder Woman in the 1940s, suddenly there are no waves. There's just a river running through the whole of the 20th century of women's continued political struggle for equality.
But not everyone was thrilled with adopting Wonder Woman as kind of this mascot of the feminist movement. I mean, Gloria Steinem may have liked her, but Betty Friedan did not.
No, and neither did, you know, you'll remember that the women's rights movement in the 1970s splintered between so-called liberal feminists, represented by people like Steinem, and radical feminists who believed in the importance of more structural change. And so Wonder Woman, for radical feminists, represented everything that was wrong with liberal feminists. Oh, well, if just you could become a superwoman, then everything would be fine. But that doesn't actually change the structure of society. Like, what, how do we deal with work and family issues, and how do we deal with pay inequality? And, you know, that debate, I guess, in a certain way continues, although Wonder Woman's place in contemporary culture is quite different now than it was in the 1970s. But it's interesting because a lot of that debate, or a lot of what people forget, is that the whatever you make of the character now, and we don't really quite know where the character is going in the culture just at this moment, she undoubtedly did have feminist origins, and she spoke to a lot of feminists over the course of the 20th century.
Does Wonder Woman still matter today? I mean, do we still need her in some way?
Well, I'm really not the person to ask. I didn't read comic books as a kid. I'm not a comic book person. I have to apologize every time I speak in public to the comic book fans in the crowd. But I had an experience when I was working on the book where friends of mine are foster parents, and I sometimes help out, take care of the foster kids. And there was a little girl visiting in my house for the afternoon. She was 8 years old. And I was looking for something to do in my house. I have only boys, so we only have boy stuff all over the place. But I had a little, like a box of old covers of DC Comics comic books. So I pulled out the box and we kind of dumped them out on the kitchen table. And, you know, there's Superman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, everything, all kinds of DC characters from the 30s and 40s. And she very methodically, this little girl who's, you know, been separated from her family, who knows what's going to happen to her next, she has no power. No one has less power than this little girl. She very methodically goes through them. She'd never seen a comic book before. And she pulls out and makes a separate stack of all of the covers that have Wonder Woman on them. And she asks me who she is and what she can do and how she is strong. And then she lays them all out and she orders them. And she, you know, she likes the ones where she's bigger instead of the ones where she's little. And I said, well, why are you so interested in Wonder Woman? And she said, because she can rescue people. And so I do think that matters. I do think that matters in a deep, deep way.
Yeah. Wow. What a story. Thank you. This has been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Jill Lepore is a New Yorker staff writer and professor of American history at Harvard. Her book, just out in paper, is called The Secret History of Wonder Woman. And she talked with Steve Paulson.